Malcolm Honlein is with us. It's weekly update time. Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. Good as always to be with you.
Sounding much better this week, Baruch Hashem.
That is true. My operatic voice is coming back.
You obviously spent quality time making sure to take whatever concoction it was that's made you better. Look, I can only imagine how many people ask you about who to vote for, about what the real policies behind the scenes are of both the Republican and Democratic Party. If the next president is Donald Trump, would that be good for Israel? The next president is Kamala Harris, would that be good? I can only imagine how often you're asked this question. With that in mind, not that you'd give an actual suggestion to anybody about who you would encourage them to vote for. But with that in mind, how did you view this week's Democratic National Convention, especially vis-a-vis the issues important to supporters of Israel?
Well, there are a lot of issues that are clearly of importance to the Jewish community. Domestic agenda, obviously, the security safety issues here are all top of mind for people. The economy impacts them all. But it was very light overall on international, hardly any mention of Israel. And if there was a reference, it was in passing and often elliptical without even sometimes mentioning Israel by name. But overall, if I were an ally of the United States, And until last night's speech, I would not have had a source of comfort that America was maintaining its commitments and would sustain its obligations and be a reliable ally, because foreign policy hardly factored into it. Now, we didn't hear all the speeches all day long, but from people who were there that I checked with, it seems that the themes were purely the domestic agenda. Vice President Harris obviously made the references that she did, both to Israel and to the, quote, Palestinians, and to Ukraine, one or two others. But the question is how these priorities play out in the rest of the campaign, and more importantly, if they win, how that would translate. And unfortunately, you have seen a lot of people around the campaign and in positions who are have troubling backgrounds and histories in terms of U.S.-Israel relations. Those are all things that will have to be clarified and to be examined. Obviously she will get a bump, and the numbers are very hard because the polls are all over the field. Yeah. A lot depends on what Trump does. Will Trump be Trump? Will Trump be more moderate than he was during this week, during most of this convention week? People are looking at, I think that the undecided vote may be bigger than they are saying.
Plus, I think that what you always say about Israel is applying now to the United States more than ever, that people are hesitant to actually tell pollsters on either side who they're voting for.
That is true. People may genuinely be undecided, but the concern that most pollsters have is, as we always used to say, they tell the truth to pollsters and lie at the polls, right, or the reverse. Right. But the people don't admit that they want to vote for Trump, I think, more than for Harris. And for Harris, it's all a new thing. People don't really know her well yet. And you have to say that they organized the convention extremely well. It was very disciplined. You didn't hear booing. You didn't hear, and that means that they were successful in excluding people who might have been disruptive, especially after, let's say, her comments on Israel last night. And that was one sentence. But overall, it was well orchestrated, even though they ran way over time. And, people will settle down now. The excitement is over. the events in Chicago. There were arrests, there were demonstrations against Israel, there was some violence, but it was nothing like what was predicted. But also people should note that the number of demonstrators was a fraction of what they had said it would be. And it was in the thousands, not in the tens of thousands, that it was measured for the most part.
What about demonstrators inside the building? There was a disturbing video that was circulating. What I assume was, I was not there, but I assume it was some type of reception area specifically for the Agudas Yisrael, the organization. And it looked like they were being infiltrated by protesters and that there was somewhat of a security problem there. Was that one exceptional thing, or were there other activities like that inside the arena?
Well, I heard from people that there were other people with signs who infiltrated periodically, but here they didn't even have signs. They just infiltrated the building. I don't know that it was in the convention center per se. There were a lot of other buildings where events were being held, and in this case you saw security move pretty quickly and move them into a stairwell and away from the event. But obviously, you know, the Agudah people are visible Jews, and so attracted, but it was a handful of people. Now, I'm not dismissive of what happened, but the you know, the overall Jewish presence, there were a lot of Jewish speakers, but not heavy, I think, on Jewish content.
By the way, also, you talk about the you said how well organized it was, and certainly, you know, deserves to be described that way. But there was one thing, you know, on a political, and again, no hostage family should turn down an opportunity to address a massive crowd and frankly, the entire world. So no criticism at all of anybody who's out there, you know, advocating for the hostages. But it seemed, if you would have asked someone a week ago if that would likely happen at the DNC, I think most people would have said no. It was sort of like a right-wing topic. It was sort of like a right-wing cause, it seemed like, in this country, and basically ignored by the left. So whoever, you know, decided to insert that into the program, I think it was frankly, you know, a very good move on their part.
Well, as they said, it's not a political issue, it's a humanitarian issue. They did not take sides. They didn't say anything that would have been perceived as being left or right, although some of the hostage families have been very critical of Netanyahu. Some of them have expressed themselves on political issues. And remember, the Republicans also had the presence of hostage families, and they were very well received. Yeah. So I think after that, it would have been a glaring omission if no one from the families had been allowed to speak, and that the response, I think, was surprising to people how warmly they were received by the crowd. And her comments on Israel generally got pretty strong response, but so did the one calling for self-determination for Palestinians. So again, we have to be careful what we read into things. Conventions are staged. They're particular audience. They're meant to, and in this case, took on added significance because it's the switch in candidates that took place. And so people really this time have to spend time, read the issues, read what they've said, what have they said in the past, who are the people likely to be influential in a cabinet, and with the tests that we're facing and are likely to face in the coming years, especially on the anti-Semitism front, on the domestically and internationally, on the security front for Israel, on the Iran front, people should take the time to study the issues and the candidates.
Oh, the tone, and again, I know it's a nuance, but, you know, this is the type of stuff that people are anxious to hear from you, what you think. I know it's nuanced, but the tone for all of this, the entire attitude in the, you know, small number of times that Israel and the situation in the Middle East was mentioned, the entire tone was set by the President of the United States on Monday. When he went ahead and basically, you know, we have to understand that both sides, I'm just paraphrasing, that both sides, you know, there's concern on both sides, and the people who are demonstrating outside, you know, we understand how concerned they are about the loss of life, et cetera, et cetera. Once he laid that down as the foundation for their, you know, sort of Middle East policy 2024, then that was it. Then the you know, the vice president didn't look, you know, nearly off base at all with her comment and evaluation last night, as you described it. And now I guess this really is the, I don't know, the policy, the platform, the attitude of the Democratic Party. Because you have to admit, outside of that initial visit by Biden to Israel after October 7th, basically this is what it's been. It's, you know, concern about loss of life on one side, and the Palestinians have a right to express themselves and look for self-determination. And at the same time, obviously, we support the fact that Israel has a right to defend itself. Is that basically sum up the Democratic attitude at the moment?
I don't think you can sum it up quite that facility. So take first the president's speech, which I did think was disappointing, because that comment was not in his speech. Wow. He added that on the spot.
Wow.
And that was, to me, more disturbing, to say that the people outside have a point. Is the point that they're calling for intifada, that they're burning American flags, that they were engaging in violence and in certainly challenging police, breaking through, calling for an end to Israel, destruction of Israel? You cannot just say, and again, I guess because people, you know, give him a lot of leeway, it's the reason why they also removed him from the candidacy. But it's also too simple to say that Israel, that the only thing they did for Israel, they did, you know, stuff in the UN, they did just sign a deal, but the $20 billion, which everybody raises with me, but when you look at it, the $20 billion, $18 billion of that, 18.8, I think, or 18.2, is for planes that don't start coming until 2029. So for the immediate relief of what Israel needs, it's less than $2 billion. And Israel still is not getting all of the armaments and weapon shipments. But on the other hand, we see a nuclear submarine with 180 Tomahawks. We see the aircraft carriers. We see, and I credit a lot of this to CENTCOM, but he can't do that on his own without the president and the Defense Department signing off on it. I don't know what Iran might have done had there not been this added presence. Actually, a lot of it just came into to the range in the last 3-4 days.
So American deterrence is responsible for Iran not making good on their threat to attack Israel?
No, I said we don't know what they would have done, because I can't ascribe it to one factor or another.
Right.
That whether they were ready, certainly whether agree. They are willing to risk the consequences, whether they, you know, the deterrence against Hezbollah and others. All of these factors we will know when the books are written and when enough people tell us. And we have heard from some people, you know, inside the enemy countries about what's going on. So all I'm saying is that we can't, the presence of an aircraft carrier is a really, and with the attendant, and it doesn't come alone, you know, it comes with an entourage of destroyers and other ships. It's a carrier group. And the same thing when you see the airplanes that have the fighter jets that have been sent to the region, including B-52 bombers and other things, they are a deterrent. It's got to be.
Right. So you'd put it on your short list of reasons for the delay in retaliating against Israel.
Right. But one of the messages that Iran got was when Israel hit the Hodeidah port in Yemen, that's exactly the same distance from Israel to the oil refineries of Iran. And remember, without that, they have virtually no income. And we had hoped that America would have hit it a long time ago, and that, you know, if we stop them from that, they can't fund. And just remember that all of these enemies all have one thing in common, that it's Iran that's enabling them. It's Iran that's supplying them. And now the efforts of Iran with China, North Korea, and Russia, forming new groups. Look at what their sales to Russia of weapons are, both the missiles, the drones, other things, and what Russia is providing them. Russia is also sending their oil through Iran to be sold. 85% of the oil Iran is selling is to China. So a small percentage goes for the domestic market. Their economy is in ruins. The people are of the unrest domestically is increasing all the time. I think that one of the things that's inhibiting them as well could be the fear of domestic reaction to forcing Israel to strike back. Israel is a lot more popular than the government of Iran is in Iran. And, you know, so we can't use any kind of looking for single factors. It's a combination of factors that will determine what each of the parties do and what they collectively do. They may want Hezbollah to take the brunt of the burden and let them go and attack. You saw the attack on Mount Moroni, so you see the escalation of 40, 50 rockets at a time in the morning in the north. None of that is to be dismissed. Hezbollah has tremendous capacity, but Israel has been eliminating their leadership, their key operatives, and striking, as you saw this week, a weapons depot. The explosion was really quite impressive, and they obviously have very good intelligence on the sites. Right now, neither side seems to want to let it go to an all-out conflagration, but we can't keep 80,000 people out of the north. And people should remember them and think about them, and we should be helping them as we do the people in the South, who are many of coming back trying to rebuild their lives, but every once in a while then get a reminder of a rocket coming from Gaza.
Yeah, understood. By the way, on the issue of, as you said, you know, firing at Yemen and the same distance of the oil refineries in Iran, I don't have the map in front of me, but I mean, is airspace one of the concerns? In other words, because Israel wouldn't have to seek permission to attack something at or near Yemen, as opposed to attacking Iran, they would have to actually make sure that they have the cooperation of certain governments, no?
Well, there are routes, there are ways. Israel had been showing that it's and demonstrating its refueling capacity for a long-distance strike. Mm-hmm. You know, the Red Sea provides an avenue, and the so maybe they would have to cross over some pieces of land, but
so that's
overall
not gonna stop
it wouldn't. But no, that will not be an inhibitor. And remember, any of the countries are waiting for Israel to do something.
Right. Yeah.
They, and Jordan, and Jordan told Iran, you cannot fly over our territory. He told Israel it also, but we expect that. But and the coalition that would stand against an attack seems to be still intact.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored digital radio. Around the world, the web at NahumSiegel.com and the Nahum Siegel Network, and of course, on the beloved NSN app. By the way, we got into a conversation last week about the whole airline thing, and I really don't remember. I mean, look, there have been wars before, and there's been, you know, a lot of rockets before. We could start listing off all the times in the last 30 years where, you know, Israel's been under attack either from the north or south on a consistent basis, or was actually at war, like in 2014, 10 years ago. But I wonder, you know, American Airlines just announced now they're delaying at least until March of 2025, which is a pretty significant amount of time, frankly. I'm just wondering if, unlike in the old days when it seems that nobody canceled their routes, if it might just be a financial issue at this point. Is it possible that all this is just an excuse because it doesn't pay for them to maintain this route right now? You know, prices of everything are so expensive and so high. I don't mean the tickets. I mean what the airline needs to pay for just to keep routes active. Is it possible that this is just an excuse to delay the process until things might become more affordable for them?
It's actually a very profitable route, and so for most of them, it's costly. Look, Turkish Air used to have 11, 12 flights a day. And, you know, because the crazy one has declared war and immediately in the beginning stopped that. And the bulk of the trade, which was a net benefit of billions of dollars to businesses in Turkey. So I don't know that you can look for dollar and cents explanations for American Airlines, this is a very profitable route. And to announce now that they're not flying till April is, very disturbing. I've not seen anybody who can explain whether that once you dismantle the route that you can't just do it for short periods. Right. We see that the European airlines are doing it for much shorter periods, a week at a time, sometimes several days. Unfortunately, now we see that some will extend even towards the Yunta period where all these flights were sold out. El Al has reached an agreement, supposedly, with Naftali Bennett that they get their taxes waived on a very, very profitable year. And they will guarantee flights from four cities, Larnaca, Athens, Vienna, I forgot the fourth. But most of those flights, I think, are sold out already anyway. But wow. It would enable you to take any airline to those cities, and then you buy a second ticket for a fixed rate that they can't change. But they've had a very profitable year, and El Al is trying to fill the gap. I know from people, including ourselves, that when you look for flights, it's very, very hard and very expensive. I think there should be more regulation of it by the government, not to allow prices just to soar uncontrolled. Because of the current situation. On the other hand, they have, I'm sure, additional insurance and other expenses that are incurred. And for the airlines, those are factors. One is whether their pilots are willing to fly to these areas. Crews are not willing to stay overnight in Israel, so they were going to refuel in places like Larnaca, which is in Cyprus, or in Athens and other things, and they would just fly in and then fly out again. After depositing the people. So it's a very complicated situation. I hope it'll be rectified. I hope people are not going to be have a hard time getting there for Yontif. I know many call me about it, but I face the same challenges. And everybody should have a private plane. That's the answer.
I just wonder. there's the quote from this morning's weekly update. I just wonder if it's even possible in the long run, I don't know, a year or two from now, to get back to the level of tourism that Israel was enjoying, especially from North America, if there's only one airline flying. Like, the numbers will never add up. It'll never be able to get close to that tipping point again if, in fact, there's only one carrier, correct?
That is certainly correct because, this El Al also has limited number of planes. They can lease planes, right. And they can augment their fleet. But it's very hard, and you have to have a pilot. And for Israel, pilots are specially trained. El Al has amazing security facilities on their planes, and the pilots know the special routes, maneuvers, etc., which is why everybody wants to fly El Al as well, because of the security, but also knowing the surety that they're going to fly as long as there's a possibility of getting in and out of Israel. They're flying, and we have to give them credit for that.
Yep.
But you're raising an important point because you can't just – the hotels can't sustain long periods without the influx of customers, and the Yom Tovim are the most lucrative and carry them then for slower months like November, December, which of late have been less. I hope there will be a lot of groups going. I hope that there will be, a lot of trips and people who will go for the October 7th and October 27th, the real yard site. I think it's October 27th for groups that are going to Israel.
25th, that Friday, 25th would be the art ceremony.
It's not celebrated. It's Shabbos, I think.
Right. The day after Shabbos Bereishis would be the commemoration, right?
Right. Day afterwards, right.
Right. That's Sunday, the day after Shabbos Bereishis. In fact, we're doing our Siyum here for the victims that Monday, the first JMAM after Shabbos Bereishis. Well, that's what concerns me, is if it's possible that we also have a this year a unique situation where the final week of the secular year, which is always a very big travel week, is Hanukkah. So an opportunity for a lot of people who are off to actually spend Hanukkah in Israel as well. So I guess between Sukkot and Hanukkah, we'll see if there's going to be any type of significant bump and if those hotels, as you described, have a chance to survive this very difficult period. All right, so six hostage bodies were found by the IDF Special Forces. Obviously, these victims killed by the enemy. These statistics, and it's a shame we have to refer to it that way, but just for point of reference, 109 hostages are believed to still be in captivity. Of them, they are assuming the Israeli government, and I guess this means, Malcolm, that the families have been informed that 34 of them are likely no longer alive. I know that you can't reveal, you know, all the conversations you have and the topic and the content of the conversations you have with high government officials, including the prime minister, but you have had to have been given some type of indication in the last couple of months about whether the majority of hostages are in fact unfortunately gone at this point. Can you tell us anything that might lead one to believe that when negotiations are happening, the majority of those that we're trying to bring back are in fact no longer living?
Well, first of all, it doesn't diminish, and I know you're not suggesting it, the fervor of the negotiations to bring back for Kfar Yisrael, to bring back the bodies. We are committed to it, to make sure they have a dignified burial. And for families, there's no respite. The Gemara even makes a reference to it, until their loved ones have come to final rest and with respect. So I have had those discussions. I think they know the reality. The families realize it as well, that many of the hostages are not alive. But in this case, they found bullet holes on them. This was not people who died. You know, then of course they're going to say it's Israeli bombing, etc. That is not the case. And they did find the bodies of some of the guards, security guards nearby, but no bullet holes in them so far. And it's very strange. They have an explanation for it. But the unfortunately, the six look like they were shot and killed. They also remember that some of the hostages were killed on October 7th or immediately in the aftermath. Right. So we know that there are still dozens alive or believed to be alive, and we have to do everything, and that's why we have to sustain it every minute, keep the pressure on in every way that we can. You see how the real nature of Sinwar, who is willing to trade everything as long as he himself is safe. He doesn't care what happens to the people in Gaza. You know, I mean, when you see this rat, you know, hiding in the underground tunnels and escaping, but that the bottom line is that he's only concerned about his own skin, and I hope the people get to see the reality of these people. They're always ready to sacrifice others, and all of them have become extremely wealthy in the process. The leaders of Hamas sitting in Qatar were billionaires, and the including Haniyeh, who was eliminated, just like the PA leadership, all become extremely wealthy. Hundreds of millions of dollars poured in every month from all the sources. Nobody yet has speaks about an accounting of what happened to all of that. How could they build hundreds and hundreds of miles of underground tunnels, sophisticated? Look at the size of some of them. Look at 50 along the Egyptian corridor, the Philadelphia corridor alone. But they're immense operations. And it takes a lot of money, a lot of cement, a lot of steel to be able to have these. And they find now one in the last week that was 3 kilometers long. I mean, this is not, you know, a closet. And it's and that also explains, look at the difficulty that Israeli troops, and many of the entrances are booby-trapped, and unfortunately soldiers are paid with their lives, and they booby-trapped the houses, they booby-trapped other things with explosives, roadside explosives. And you think of what Israeli soldiers have accomplished. It, you know, people I know are frustrated that it's more than 300 days, but It's unbelievable. I interviewed John Spencer yesterday from West Point, who's the world's leading expert on urban warfare. And when you hear his account, number one, about the numbers not being true. Number two, about the culpability of Israel, that the extent to which they go to avoid civilian casualties and what they're facing in this area. Schools built on top of the tunnels, or a tunnel built under the schools, UNRWA facilities completely corrupted and used to front. And they can't deny it because they know the electricity is going into it. They know everything. They have to hear it. They see it, what's going on. So, you know, I know people ask a lot of questions about why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? When you're on the front line and you're trying to limit civilian casualties to the degree that you can, and the numbers, if we ever get true numbers, will show that half of them were terrorists of the people killed, and that the numbers they're claiming about the civilian casualties are completely distorted.
Did he make any progress this week, Secretary of State Blinken, in terms of getting to a final deal?
It's hard to say. Israel essentially agreed to what he wanted, but Netanyahu set a restriction about remaining on the Philadelphia corridor and Netzarim, and those are essential points at this stage, not to allow them to rebuild, not to allow them to do it. Even Egypt said that they would accept Israel's continued presence there. It's not permanent. And you know, that we hear saw statements from from the U.S. officials that they're not going to allow permanent occupation. We're not talking about a permanent occupation. You have a war still going on, and not to have those not to have troops at those critical points. We see that the ability to be able to move quickly into back to Khan Yunis, back to other places where they capture or kill, eliminate dozens of terrorists in a single day. They find them. They know where they are. They're monitoring it. And again, hitting very specific locations. They're not bombing blocks. They're not doing indiscriminate thing, even though it puts our soldiers at risk. They are doing it still in very precision, precise and carefully planned operations. They get no credit for it, but they're doing it. And there's plenty of food, as I've said 100 times over months. There's no famine. It's a myth. And yet the lies at the UN, and today the Palestinians are going to go into the UN, demand that the international court ruling that Israel be given a deadline to get out of, not of Gaza, not out of the north, but out of Yudun Shomron. And, you know, of course, they will, hopefully the United States will veto it. But they will have, again, the propaganda platform. And let's see how our European friends vote on this.
Finally, did you hear about this mass bomb threat against Jewish organizations and institutions in Canada?
Yeah, so it was an email that was sent simultaneously to a number of institutions. And, you know, it doesn't take much to do it. We're seeing threats on the internet. They have the enemies of including places like Iran, and are have great facility in this regard. They built up capacity to undermine both the United States as well as Israel and European countries, and sabotaging, and their lines have been sabotaged in return. You know, the battlefront is not just in Gaza and in the north, but it's on the computer and the internet, and we see how many times lines of communication systems are being brought down, and to understand that it can be deadly, that this is not to be dismissed. I often believe that when they advertise such a threat, they know that they're not going to do it. But it's disarming for the communities. It makes people nervous. Then people don't go then to shul. They don't go to community events because of course. All of these implications are serious, and we see enough serious attempts and violence and break-in. And Canada has had as many anti-Semitic attacks as the United States, with a much, much smaller population. But it's very serious. Toronto, Montreal, other areas, the numbers are quite astounding. And you know that, but the Toronto area is long an outpost of the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamists going back for decades. I talked about it on this show probably 15, 20 years ago, and we had approached the government of Canada about it. We had allies in Canada, who institutions that were pressing the government because they allowed them to establish themselves there, and now we're reaping the price for all of that, but also true in Europe and elsewhere, as well as in the United States, with an open border where a Palestinian terrorist was on the wanted list, was captured. And, you know, there's no reason that they can't. And America is big. They operate freely and can pose serious dangers here.
Thank you so much. Have a good Shabbos. We will speak, please God, next week.
And be optimistic. Nachmu, Nachmu, Ami, last week, people should be comforted. Don't worry, we're going to get through this. We have gotten through worse, but the real key is Achdus, stay together. Jews, be together, be involved. We have a critical election coming up. We have many other important decisions to make. Please stay together, and most of all, stay with our kids on campuses. Let them know they're not alone. Reach out to them. Tell them that you're there for them. Every community should be reaching out to the universities and colleges in their district and putting on the pressure. Thank God Virginia Fox, the chair of the House Committee and chair of the Ways and Means Committee, sent notices to 10 universities. They're summoning Columbia, which has not responded at all to their subpoenas for information and stuff. We have to keep their feet to the fire all the time to make it a safe place for our kids.
100%. Many thanks. Have a good Shabbos. That is Malcolm Homeline, of course. Weekly update, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Friday morning, Erev Shabbos, Parshas Akev, with candlelighting in New York at 7:21.